Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. In the course of this podcast over the last 2 years and change, I've mentioned an article written by Senator Patrick Moynihan back in 1993 entitled Defining Deviancy Down. I must have mentioned it at least five, maybe six times, and it came up in a previous podcast. And I thought rather than mention the essay written by Senator Moynihan, I'd read it today. It's not so long that it's not such a long essay that it would take a long time to read it, so I'll be fast. But first, I'd like to give you a quick background about Senator Moynihan. So Patrick Moynihan was a U.S. Senator from New York from 1977 to 2001. Prior to that, he was ambassador to the United Nations briefly from 1975 to 1976. And prior to that, he was ambassador to India from 1973 to 1975. Because he was a lifelong Democrat, but he worked for administrations of both parties over the years, including Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Johnson, and Kennedy. The full title of his essay is called Defining Deviancy Down, How We've Become Accustomed to Alarming Levels of Crime and Destructive Behavior. It first appeared in a larger piece. It was an excerpt from a larger piece called No Surrender, which he published in 1993 in the City Journal, which is a journal put out by the Manhattan Institute. And at the time, crime was through the roof. A crack had first appeared on the scene, and crime was through the roof nationwide. And we subsequently got it slightly under control. However, anyone who's paying attention will note that crime is going up nationwide again. And using my hometown, New York City, as an example, just a couple of mayors ago, New York City was touted as the safest big city in America. And just in the last few years, crime has been going up roughly 5% a year for the last few years. And right now, a resident of New York City has a 1 in 47 chance of being a victim of a crime. So even though this essay was written in 1993, I think it's still pertinent today. And as I said before, I reference it quite often on this podcast, and I figured I'd read it on this episode. So anyone who's listening to the podcast on a regular basis would know what the hell I'm talking about when I do reference it, because I have a feeling I'll be referencing it again in the future. So I'll read it rather briskly, but I'll be slow enough that you can hopefully understand it with my New York accent. Defining Deviancy Down, How We've Become Accustomed to Alarming Levels of Crime and Destructive Behavior, by Daniel Patrick Moynihan. In one of the founding texts of sociology, The Rules of Sociological Method, in 1895, Emil Durkheim set it down that crime is normal. It is, he wrote, completely impossible for any society entirely free of it to exist. By defining what is deviant, we are enabled to know what it is not, and hence to live by shared standards. Durkheim does not imply that we ought to approve of crime. Pain has likewise nothing desirable about it, but we need to understand its function. He saw religion, in the sociologist Randall Collins' terms, as fundamentally a set of ceremonial actions assembling the group, heightening its emotions, and focusing its members on symbols of their common belongingness. In this context, a punishment ceremony creates social solidarity. The matter was pretty much left at that until 70 years later, when, in 1965, K.T. Erickson published Wayward Puritans, a study of crime rates in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. The plan behind the book, as Erickson put it, was to test Durkheim's notion that the number of deviant offenders a community can afford to recognize is likely to remain stable over time. The notion proved out very well indeed, despite occasional crime waves, when ignorant Quakers refused to take off their hats in presence of magistrates. The amount of deviance in this corner of 17th century New England fitted nicely with the supply of stocks and whipping posts. Erickson remarks, "It is one of the arguments of the study that the amount of deviation a community encounters is apt to remain fairly constant over time. To start at the beginning, it is a simple logistic fact that the number of deviances which come to a community's attention are limited by the kinds of equipment it uses to detect and handle them. And to that extent, the rate of deviation found in a community is at least a part of the function of the size and complexity of its social control apparatus. A community's capacity for handling deviance, let us say, can be roughly estimated by counting its prison cells and hospital beds, its policemen and psychiatrists, its courts and clinics. Most communities, it would seem, operate with the expectation that a relatively constant number of control agents is necessary to cope with a relatively constant number of offenders. The amount of men, money, and material assigned by society to, quote, do something about deviant behavior does not vary appreciably over time. And the implicit logic which governs the community's efforts to man a police force or maintain a suitable facilities for the mentally ill seems to be that there is a fairly stable quota of trouble which should be anticipated. In this sense, the agencies of control often seem to define their job as that of keeping deviance within bounds rather than of obliterating it altogether. Many judges, for example, assume that severe punishments are a greater deterrent to crime than moderate ones, and so it is important to note that many of them are apt to impose harsher penalties when crime seems to be on the increase, and more lenient ones when it does not. Almost as if the power of the bench were being used to keep the crime rate from getting out of hand. Erickson was taking issue with what he describes as a dominant strain in sociological thinking that took for granted that well-structured society is, quote, somehow designed to prevent deviant behavior from occurring, end quote. In both authors, Durkheim and Erickson, there is an undertone that suggests that with deviancy, as with most social goods, there is a continuing problem of demand exceeding supply. Durkheim invites us to imagine a society of saints, a perfect cloister of exemplary individuals. Crimes, property so-called, will there be unknown, but faults which appear venial to the layman will create there the same scandal that the ordinary offense does in ordinary consciousness. If then this society has the power to judge and punish, it will define these acts as criminal and will treat them as such. It would not appear that Durkheim anywhere contemplates the possibility of too much crime. Clearly, his theory would have required him to deplore such a development, but the possibility seems never to have occurred to him. Erickson, writing much later in the 20th century, contemplates both possibilities. Quote, deviant persons can be said to supply needed services to society, end quote. There is no doubt a tendency for the supply of any needed thing to run short, but he is consistent. There can, he believes, be too much of a good thing, hence, quote, the number of deviant offenders a community can afford to recognize is likely to remain stable over time, end quote. Social scientists are said to be on the lookout for poor fellows getting a bum rap, But here is a theory that clearly implies that there are circumstances in which society will choose not to notice behavior that would be otherwise controlled or disapproved or even punished. It appears to me that this is, in fact, what we in the United States have been doing of late. I proffer the thesis that over the past generation, since the time Erickson wrote, the amount of deviant behavior in American society has increased beyond the levels of beyond the levels the community can afford to recognize, and that accordingly, we have been redefining deviancy so as to exempt such conduct previously stigmatized, and also quietly raising the normal level in categories where behavior is now abnormal by any earlier standard. This redefining has evoked fierce resistance from defenders of old standards and accounts for much of the present cultural war, which is proclaimed by many at the 1992 Republican National Convention. Let me then offer three categories of redefinition in these regards: the altruistic, the opportunistic, and the normalizing. The first category, the altruistic, may be illustrated by the deinstitutionalization movement within the mental health profession that appeared in the 1950s. The second category, the opportunistic, is seen in the interest group rewards derived from the acceptance of alternative family structures. The third category, the normalizing, is to be observed in the growing acceptance of unprecedented levels of violent crime. It happens that I was present at the beginning of the deinstitutionalization movement. Early in 1955, Averell Harriman, then the new governor of New York, met with his new commissioner of mental hygiene, Dr. Paul Hock, who described the development at one of the state mental hospitals of a tranquilizer derived from a Rohwolfia. I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly. The medication had been clinically tested and appeared to be an effective treatment for many severely psychotic patients, thus increasing the percentage of patients discharged. Dr. Hock recommended that it be used system-wide. Harriman found the money. That same year, Congress created a Joint Commission on Mental Health and Illness, whose mission was to formulate comprehensive and realistic recommendations in this area, which was then a matter of considerable public concern. Year after year, the population of mental institutions grew. Year after year, new facilities had to be built. Never mind the complexities, population growth, and such like matters. There was a general unease. Durkheim's constant continued to be exceeded. In spanning the century, the life of W. Averell Harriman, Rudy Abramson writes, quote, New York's mental hospitals in 1955 were overflowing warehouses, and new patients were being admitted faster than space could be found for them. When he was inaugurated, 94,000 New Yorkers were confined to state hospitals. Admissions were running at more than 2,500 a year and rising, making the Department of Mental Hygiene the fastest growing, most expensive, most hopeless department of state government. The discovery of tranquilizers was adventitious. Physicians were seeking cures for disorders that were just beginning to be understood. Even a limited success made it possible to believe that the incidence of this particular range of disorders, which had seemingly required persons to be confined against their will or even awareness, could be greatly reduced. The Congressional Commission submitted its report in 1961. It proposed a nationwide program of deinstitutionalization. Late in 1961, President Kennedy appointed an interagency committee to prepare legislative recommendations based on the report. I represented Secretary of Labor Arthur J. Goldberg on this committee and drafted its final submission. This included the recommendation of the National Institute of Mental Health that 2,000 community mental health centers, one per 100,000 of population, be built by 1980. A buoyant presidential message to Congress followed early in 1963. Quote, if we apply our medical knowledge and social insights fully, President Kennedy pronounced, all but a small portion of the mentally ill can eventually achieve a wholesome and constructive social adjustment. A concerted national attack on mental disorders was now possible and practical. The president signed the Community Mental Health Centers Construction Act on October 31st, 1963, his last public bill signing ceremony. He gave me a pen. The mental hospitals emptied out. At the time, Governor Harriman met with Dr. Hawk in 1955. There were 93,314 adult residents of mental institutions maintained by New York State. As of August 1992, there were 11,363. This occurred across the nation. However, the number of community mental health centers never came near the goal of 2,000 proposed community centers. Only some of the 482 received federal construction funds between 1963 and 1980. The next year, 1981, the program was folded into the Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Block Grant and disappeared from view. Even when centers were built, the results were hardly as hoped for. David F. Musto of Yale writes that the planners had bet on improving national mental health by improving the quality of general community life through expert knowledge, if not merely by more efficient or effective treatment of the already ill. There was no such knowledge. However, worse luck, the belief that there was such knowledge took hold within sectors of the profession that saw institutionalization as an unacceptable mode of social control. These activists subscribed to a redefining mode of their own. Mental patients were said to have been labeled and were not to be drugged. Musto says of these battles followed that they were so intense and dramatic, precisely because both sides shared the fantasy of an omnipotent and omniscient mental health technology which could thoroughly reform society. The prize seemed to be eminently worth fighting for. But even as the federal government turned to other matters, the mental institutions continued to release inmates. Professor Fred Siegel of Cooper Union observes, in the great wave of moral deregulation that began in the mid-1960s, the poor and the insane were freed from the fetters of middle-class mores. They might henceforth sleep in doorways as often as they choose. The problem of homelessness appeared, characteristically defined as persons who lacked affordable housing. The altruistic mode of redefinition is just that. There is no reason to believe that there was any real increase in mental illness at the time deinstitutionalization began. Yet there was such a perception, and this enabled good people to try to do good, however unavailing in the end. Our second, or opportunistic, mode of redefinition reveals at most a nominal intent to do good. The true object is to do well, a long-established motivation among mortals. In this pattern, a growth of deviancy makes possible a transfer of resources, including prestige, to those who control the deviant population. This control would be jeopardized if any serious effort were made to reduce the deviancy in question. This leads to assorted strategies for redefining the behavior in question as not all that deviant, really. In the years from 1963 to 1965, the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of Labor picked up the first tremors of what was Samuel H. Preston in the 1984 presidential address to the Population Association of America would call the earthquake that shuddered through the American family in the past 20 years. The New York Times recently provided a succinct accounting of Preston's point. 30 years ago, one in every 40 white children were born to an unmarried mother. Today, it is one in five, according to federal data. Among blacks, two of three children were born to an unmarried mother. 30 years ago, the figure was one in five. In 1991, Paul Offner and I published longitudinal data showing that of children born in the years 1967 to 1969, some 22.1% were dependent on welfare. That is to say, age of families with dependent children before reaching age 18. This broke down as 15.7% of white children, 72.3% of black children. Projections for children born in 1980 gave rates of 22.2% and 82.9%, respectively. A year later, a New York Times series on welfare and poverty called this a startling finding, a symptom of vast social calamity. And yet there is little evidence that these facts are regarded as a calamity in municipal government. To the contrary, there is a general acceptance of the situation as normal. Political candidates raise the subject, often to the point of dwelling on it. But while there is a good deal of demand for symbolic change, there is none of the marshaling of resources that is associated with significant social action. Nor is there any lack of evidence that there is a serious social problem here. Richard T. Gill writes of an accumulation of data showing that intact biological parent families offer children very large advantages compared to any other family or non-family structure one can imagine. Correspondingly, the disadvantages associated with single-parent families spill over into other areas of social policy that now attract great public concern. Leroy L. Schwartz, M.D., and Mark W. Stanton argue that the real quest regarding a government-run health system, such as that of Canada or Germany, is whether it would work in a country that has social problems that countries like Canada and Germany don't share to the same extent. Health problems reflect ways of living, the way of life associated with such social pathologies as the breakdown of the family structure lead to medical pathologies. Schwartz and Stanton conclude, the United States is paying dearly for its social and behavioral problems, for they now have become medical problems as well. To cite another example, there is at present no more vexing problem of social policy in the United States than that posed by education. A generation of ever more ambitious statutes and reforms have produced weak responses at best and a fair amount of what could more simply be called dishonesty. Everyone knows that the Head Start works, the Head Start program. By the year 2000, American students will be the first in the world in science and mathematics. None of this should surprise us. The 1966 report, Equality of Education Opportunity, by James S. Coleman and his associates, established that the family background of students played a much stronger role in student achievement relative to variations in the 10 and still standard measures of school quality. In a 1992 study entitled America's Smallest School, The Family, Paul Barton came up with the elegant and persuasive concept of parent-pupil ratio as a measure of school quality. Barton, who was on the policy planning staff in the Department of Labor in 1965, noted the great increase in the proportion of children living in single-parent families since then. He further noted that the proportion varies widely among the states and is related to variation in achievement among them. The correlation between the percentage of eighth graders living in two-parent families and average mathematics proficiency is a solid 0.74. North Dakota, highest on the math test, is second highest on the family composition scale. That is, it is second in percentage of kids coming from two-parent homes. The District of Columbia, lowest on the family scale, is second lowest in the test score. A few months before Barton's study appeared, I published an article showing that the correlation between eighth grade math scores and distance of state capitals from the Canadian border was 0.522, a respectable showing. By contrast, the correlation with per pupil expenditure was a derisory 2.03. I offered the policy proposal that states wishing to improve their schools should move closer to Canada. This would be difficult, of course, but so would it be to change the parent-pupil ratio. Indeed, the 1990 census found that for the District of Columbia, apart from Ward 3, west of Rock Creek Park, the percentage of children living in single-parent families in the seven remaining wards ranged from a low of 63.6% to a high of 75.7%. This being a one-time measurement, over time the proportions become asymptotic, and this in the nation's capital. No demand for change come from that community, or as near to no demand as makes no matter, for there is good money to be made out of bad schools. This is a statement that will no doubt please many a hard heart and displease many genuinely concerned to bring about change. To the latter, a group of which I would like to include myself, I would only say that we are obliged to ask why things do not change. For a period, there was some speculation that if family structure got bad enough, this mode of deviancy would have less punishing effects on children. In 1991, Deborah A. Dawson of the National Institutes of Health examined the thesis that, quote, the psychological effects of divorce and single parenthood on children were strongly influenced by a sense of shame in being different from the norm, end quote. If this were so, the effect should have fallen off in the 1980s, when being from a single parent home became much more common. It did not. The problems associated with task overload among single parents, more constant in nature, Dawson wrote, adding that since the adverse effects had not diminished, they were not based on stigmatization, but rather on inherent problems in alternative family structures. Alternative here meaning any other than two-parent families. We should take note of such candor. Writing in the Journal of Marriage and the Family in 1989, Sarah McClanahan and Karen Booth noted, whereas, quote, whereas a decade ago the prevailing view was that the single motherhood had no harmful effects on children, recent research is less optimistic, end quote. The year 1990 saw more of this lesson. In a paper prepared for the Progressive Policy Institute, Elaine Quila Kamarak and William H. Galston wrote that, quote, if the economic effects of family breakdown are clear, the psychological effects are now just coming into focus, end quote. They cite Carl Zinnmeister, there is a mountain of scientific evidence showing that when families disintegrate, children often end up with intellectual, physical, and emotional scars that persist for life. We talk about the drug crisis, the education crisis, and the problems of teen pregnancy and juvenile crime. But all these ills trace back predominantly to one source, broken families. As for juvenile crime, they cite Douglas Smith and G. Roger Jajora, quote, neighborhoods with larger percentages of youth, those aged 12 to 20, and areas with higher percentages of single-parent households also have higher rates of violent crime, end quote. They add, quote, the relationship is so strong that controlling for family configuration erases the relationship between race and crime and between low income and crime. This conclusion shows up time and time again in the literature. Poverty is far from the sole determinant of crime, end quote. But the large point is avoided. In a 1992 essay, The Expert's Story of Marriage, Barbara Defoe Whitehead examined the story of marriage as is conveyed in today's high school and college textbooks. Nothing amiss in this tale. It goes like this. The life course is full of exciting options. The lifestyle options available to individuals seeking a fulfilling personal relationship include living a heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual single lifestyle, living in a commune, having a group marriage, being a single parent, or living together. Marriage is yet another lifestyle choice. However, before choosing marriage, individuals should weigh its costs and benefits against other lifestyle options and should consider what they want to get out of their intimate relationships. Even within marriage, different people want different things. For example, some people marry for companionship. Some marry in order to have children. Some marry for emotional and financial security. Though marriage can offer a rewarding path to personal growth, it is important to remember that it cannot provide a secure or permanent status. Many people will make the decision between marriage and singlehood many times throughout their life. Divorce represents part of the normal family life cycle. It should not be viewed as either deviant or tragic, as it has been in the past. Rather, it establishes a process for uncoupling and thereby serves as the foundation for individual renewal and new beginnings. History commences to be rewritten. In 1992, the Select House Committee on Children, Youth, and Families of the U.S. House of Representatives held a hearing on Investing in Families, a Historical Perspective. A fact sheet prepared by the committee staff began Historical Shifts in Family Composition Challenging Conventional Wisdom. While in modern times the percentage of children living with one parent has increased, more children lived with just one parent in colonial America. The fact sheet proceeded to list program on program for which federal funds were allegedly reduced in the 1980s. We then come to a summary. Between 1970 and 1991, the value of AFDC, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, benefits decreased by 41%. In spite of proven success of Head Start, only 28% of eligible children are being served. As of 1990, more than $18 billion in child support went uncollected. At the same time, the poverty rate among single-parent families with children under 18 was 44%. Between 1980 and 1990, the rate of growth in total federal budget was four times greater than the rate of growth in children's programs. In other words, benefits paid to mothers and children have gone down steadily, as indeed they have done. But no proposal is made to restore benefits to an earlier level or even maintain their value, as is the case with other indexed Social Security programs. Instead, we go directly to the subject of education spending. Nothing new. In 1969, President Nixon proposed a guaranteed income, the Family Assistance Plan. This was described as an income strategy against the service strategy. It may or may not have been a good idea, but it was a clear one, and the resistance of service providers to it was equally clear. In the end, it was defeated to the huzzas of advocates of welfare rights. What is going on here is simply that a large increase in what was once seen as deviancy has provided opportunity to a wide spectrum of interest groups that benefit from redefining the problem as essentially normal and doing little to reduce it. A normalizing category most directly corresponds to Erickson's proposition that the number of deviant offenders a community can afford to recognize is likely to remain stable over time. Here we are dealing with the popular psychological notion of denial. In 1969, having reached the conclusion that there would be a dramatic increase in single-parent families, I reached the further conclusion that this would in turn lead to a dramatic increase in crime. In an article in America, I wrote, from the wild Irish slums of the 19th century eastern seaboard to the riot-torn suburbs of Los Angeles, there is one unmistakable lesson in American history. A community that allows a large number of young men to grow up in broken families dominated by women, never acquiring any stable relationship to male authority, never acquiring any set of rational expectations about the future, that community asks for and gets chaos. Crime, violence, unrest, unrestrained lashing out at the whole social structure, that is not only to be expected, it is very near to inevitable. The inevitable, as we now know, has come to pass. But here again, our response is curiously passive. Crime is a more or less continuous subject of political pronouncements. And from time to time, it will be at or near the top of opinion polls as a matter of public concern. But it never gets much further than that. In the words of spoken from the bench, Judge Edwin Torres of the New York State Supreme Court, 12th District, described how, quote, the slaughter of the innocent marches unabated. Subway riders, bodega owners, cab drivers, babies in laundromats, at cash machines, on elevators and hallways, end quote. In personal communication, he writes, this numbness, this near narcoleptic state can diminish the human condition to the level of combat infantrymen who, in protracted campaigns, can eat their battlefield rations seated on the bodies of the fallen, friend and foe alike. A society that loses its sense of outrage is doomed to extinction. There is no expectation that this will change, nor any efficacious public assistance that it do so. The crime level has been normalized. Consider the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. In 1929, in Chicago, during Prohibition, four gangsters killed seven gangsters on February 14th. The nation was shocked. The event became legend. It merits not one but two entries in the World Book Encyclopedia. I leave it to others to judge, but it would appear that the society in the 1920s was simply not willing to put up with this degree of deviancy. In the end, the Constitution was amended, and Prohibition, which lay behind so much gangster violence, ended. In recent years, again, in the context of illegal traffic and controlled substances, this form of murder has returned, but it has done so at a level that includes denial. James Q. Wilson comments that Los Angeles has the equivalent of a St. Valentine's Day massacre every weekend. Even the most ghastly reenactments of such human slaughter produce only moderate responses. On the morning after the close of the Democratic National Convention in New York City in July, there was such an account in the second section of the New York Times. It was not a big story, bottom of the page, but with a headline that got your attention. Three slain in Bronx apartment, but a baby is saved. A subhead continued, a mother's last act was to hide her little girl under the bed. The article described a drug execution, the now routine blindfolds made from duct tape, a man and a woman and a teenager involved. Each had been shot once in the head. The police had found them a day later. They also found under a bed a three-month-old baby, dehydrated but alive. A lieutenant remarked of the mother, quote, in her last dying act, she protected her baby. She probably knew she was going to die, so she stuffed the baby where she knew it would be safe, end quote. But the matter was left there. The police would do their best. But the event passed quickly, forgotten by the next day. It will never make the world book, nor is it likely that any great heed will be paid to an uncanny reenactment of the Prohibition drama a few months later, also in the Bronx. The Times story, page B3, reported, nine men posing as police are indicted in three murders. Drug dealers were kidnapped for ransom. The Daily News story, same day, page 17, made it four murders, adding nice details about torture techniques. The gang members posed as Federal Drug Enforcement Administration agents, real badges and all. The victims were drug dealers, whose families were uneasy about calling the police. Ransom seems generally to have been set in the $650,000 range. Some paid, some got it in the back of the head. So it goes. Yet violent killings, often random, go on unabated. Peaks continue to attract some notice. But these are peaks above average levels that 30 years ago would have been thought epidemic. Los Angeles, August 24th. 22 people were killed in Los Angeles over the weekend, the worst period of violence in the city since it was ravaged by riots earlier this year, the police said today. 24 others were wounded by gunfire or stabbings, including a 19-year-old woman in a wheelchair who was shot in the back when she failed to respond to a motorist who asked for directions in South Los Angeles. The guy stuck a gun out the window and just fired at her, said a police spokesman, Lieutenant David Rock. The woman was later described as being in stable condition. Among those who died was an off-duty officer shot while investigating reports of a prowler in a neighbor's yard, and a Little League baseball coach who argued with the father of a boy he was coaching. The police said at least nine of the deaths were gang-related, including that of a 14-year-old girl killed in a fight between rival gangs. 51 people were killed in 3 days of rioting that started April 29th after the acquittal of four police officers in the beating of Rodney King. Los Angeles usually has an above-average violence during August, but the police were at loss to explain the sudden rise. On an average weekend in August, 14 fatalities occur. Not to be outdone, 2 days later in the poor Bronx came up with a... Let me restate that. Not to be outdone, 2 days later, the poor Bronx came up with a near record, as reported in the New York Newsday. Armed with a 9mm pistols, shotguns, and M16 rifles, a group of masked men and women poured out of two vehicles in the South Bronx early yesterday and sprayed a stretch of Longwood Avenue in the fusillade of bullets, injuring 12 people. A. Kai Erickson of the future will surely need to know that the Department of Justice in 1990 found that Americans reported only about 38% of all crimes and 48% of violent crimes. This, too, can be seen as a means of normalizing violent crimes. In much the same way, the vocabulary of crime reporting can be seen to move toward the normal seeming. A teacher is shot on her way to class. The Times subhead reads, struck in the shoulder in the year's first shooting inside a school, first of a season. It's too early, however, to know how to regard the arrival of the doctors on the scene declaring crime a public health emergency. The June 10th, 1992 issue of the Journal of American Medical Association was devoted entirely to papers on the subject of violence, principally the violence associated with firearms. An editorial in the issue, signed by former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop and Dr. George D. Lundberg, is entitled, quote, Violence in America, a Public Health Emergency, end quote. Their proposition is admirably succinct. Regarding violence in our society as purely psychological, regarding violence in our society as purely a sociological matter or one of law enforcement has led to unmitigated failure. It is time to test further whether violence can be amenable to medical/public health interventions. We believe violence in America to be a public health emergency. Largely unresponsive methods thus far used in its control. The solutions are very complex, but possible. Again, this process began during the Harriman administration in New York in the 1950s. In the 1960s, the morbidity and mortality associated with automobile crashes was, it could be argued, a major public health problem. The public health strategy, it could also be argued, brought the problem under a measure of control. Not in the 1970s and 1980s, as the Journal of American Medical Association would have us think. The federal legislation involved was signed in 1965. Such a strategy would surely produce insights into the control of violence that elude law enforcement professionals, but whether it would change anything is another question. For some years now, I have legislation in the Senate that would prohibit the manufacture of 25 and 32 caliber bullets. These are two calibers most typically used with guns known as Saturday Night Specials. Guns don't kill people, I argue. Bullets do. Moreover, we have a 2-century supply of handguns, but only a 4-year supply of ammunition. A public health official would immediately see the logic of trying to control the supply of bullets rather than that of guns. Even so, now that the doctor has come, it is important that criminal violence not be defined down by epidemiologists. Doctors Koop and Lundberg note that in 1990, in the state of Texas, deaths from firearms, for the first time in many decades, surpassed deaths from motor vehicles by 3,443 to 3,309. A good comparison, and yet keep in mind that the number of motor vehicle deaths having leveled off since the 1960s is now pretty well accepted as normal at somewhat less than 50,000 a year, which is somewhat less than the level of the 1960s. The carnage, as it was once thought to be, is now accepted as normal. This is the price we pay for high-speed transportation. There is a benefit associated with it, but there's also no benefit associated with homicide and no good in getting used to it. Epidemiologists have powerful insights that can contribute to lessening the medical trauma, but they must be wary of normalizing the social pathology that leads to such trauma. The hope, if there be such, of this essay has been twofold. It is first to suggest that the Durkheim constant, as I put it, is maintained by a dynamic process which adjusts upwards and downwards. Liberals have traditionally been alert for upward redefining that does injustice to individuals. Conservatives have been correspondingly sensitive to downward redefining that weakens the social standards. It might not help if we could all agree that there is a dynamic at work here. It is not revealed truth, nor yet a scientifically derived formula. It is simply a pattern we observe in ourselves. Nor is it rigid. There may once have been an unchanging supply of jail cells with more or less determined the number of prisoners. No longer. We are building new prisons at a prodigious rate. Similarly, the executioner is back. There is something of a competition in Congress to think up new offenses for which death penalty is seen the only available deterrent, possibly also modes of execution, as in Fry the Kingpins. Even so, we are getting used to a lot of behavior that is not good for us. As noted earlier, Durkheim states that there is nothing desirable about pain. Surely what he meant was that there is nothing pleasurable. Pain, even so, is an indispensable warning signal. But societies under stress, much like individuals, would turn to painkillers of various kinds that end up concealing real damage. There is surely nothing desirable about this. If our analysis wins general acceptance, if, for example, more of us came to share Judge Torres's genuine alarm at the trivialization of the lunatic crime rate in this city, we might surprise ourselves how well we respond to the manifest decline of the American civic order. Might. Thank you.